Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kim. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 309, recorded November 1st, 2016.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers. As you may have noticed, Kelly is not with us tonight, so Laurelyn, our daughter, has joined us. Kelly will be back next week, but we have our special guest.
Hi.
And so, thank you for joining us, Laurelyn. Do you have anything to say for yourself?
I like cheese.
Okay, cool. All right. So, who do we have on the show today?
Today we have Jeremiah in the Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Joe in Hudsonville, Michigan.
So, two Michiganders. That's cool.
Were they Michigeese?
No, they're actually called Michiganders.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of cool. At least that's one of the terms that can be used. Okay, so what does Jeremiah in Grand Rapids say?
He says, "Hello, I'm glad you liked the video of Pete. I hope it inspires some people to try something similar with their lizards. I'm still working on getting my 20-gallon extra tall the way I want it. The Java fern is progressing and has been dropping pups / crawlers. They don't have rhizomes and barely any roots. Is there a good way to grow them in a separate container? Should I use an air stone? Also, do you have any tips on using a python water changer with a lot of small fish? I don't want to vacuum any fish, just the debris in the sand."
Okay, pause there. We're going to answer some of those questions. Okay, so for the Java fern pups, you could move them to a different container. You don't necessarily need to. They'll do fine in the parent tank. I would say that I don't know that an air stone matters that much, but if you want to get them to grow decently, you want an environment where they can have some nutrients and decent light and so on. I mean, ideally, if you want to get them to grow well, I would use CO2. I think you're using CO2 in your main tank, aren't you? Or are you just using Excel? I don't remember. Anyway, that would help. But unless you have another tank set up that's going to give them some nutrients and good light and so on, and you really want to increase their growth, I just leave them where they are. If you don't really mind how fast they grow, then you could set them up in almost any way, and they do fine. I mean, they don't need a lot of light. They don't need huge amounts of nutrients. So you could, you know, put them in a separate place. If you want to drop them into a shrimp tank or something like that, they would do fine. There are a lot of options there, but I don't know that an air stone in and of itself is going to be that important, nor would it be particularly harmful. You could do it if you wanted to. Okay, so as for using a python water changer with a lot of small fish, that can be tricky. One thing you can do is put a loose mesh bag over the end of it so that the water current, put a loose mesh bag over the end so that when the water is being drawn up, the loose bag can kind of go up into the python a little bit, just an inch or two, and you want the mesh to be big enough so that the coarser particles of detritus can go up it, but the fish can't get caught in it. You can use a rubber band to attach it. Something like that can work. Generally, though, I understand the issue with smaller fish. It can be easier to suck them up, and that can help prevent it, but I haven't had a lot of problems even with fish with smaller fish. They tend to swim out before it's a problem, but I'm ready to switch the valve if I notice one gets sucked up. It has happened once or twice, and I just switch the valve and then let it drain. But if you were to use a kind of a coarse mesh bag on the end, that could help. Okay, now go ahead, Laurelyn.
He also says, "In an exciting update, I found out a coworker is looking to get rid of a 40-gallon lawn aquarium. I'm not sure what I wanted to put in it. I'm considering an axolotl, an African clodfrog, or some sort of largest fish, though appropriately sized to spend its entire life in a 40-gallon. Any suggestions? Thanks."
What do you think, Laurelyn? Do you have any? You have an axolotl?
Yeah, I've got an axolotl.
So, would you suggest an axolotl?
For a 40-gallon? It seems like it'd be kind of big. You could have a couple in there, I think.
Yeah, you could have a couple in there, and that would be cool. I think our zoo has 3 in a 40-gallon. Is it a 40-gallon? I think it might be. It's kind of a long, it might be a 40-gallon extra long, but I think it's right about there. And they seem to do well in there. African clawed frog would do fine in there, but you wouldn't need necessarily a 40-gallon for one frog. Again, you could put one or two in there, maybe even three. Some sort of largish fish. Yeah, you could definitely do several different types of fish in there. I'm telling you one thing that I would like to do if I had a 40-gallon long, I would probably do some gelidochromous Tanganyikan cichlids on one side in a rock formation, rock structure, and then I would do shell dwellers on the other side. I think that would be cool. But that's not what you're asking. You're thinking of a largish fish. A specimen cichlid, one that's not very big, that you could do in a 40-gallon, there's some options there. You could do like one angelfish. They can get pretty interactive. They certainly recognize you and get excited when you come near the tank. That could be kind of fun. And they don't get so big that a 40-gallon would be ridiculously too small for it, like it would be for an Oscar or, you know, something like that. It gets really big. So there's some options there. Okay, let's see. Yeah, let us know what you think. And if anyone else has suggestions for Jeremiah, what to put in this 40-gallon. I do like the idea of a wet pet. That's what people sometimes call it when you have a fish you keep as a showcase specimen in the tank. Another good one, actually, you could keep some type of goldfish in there if that's interesting to you. I know some people are not as excited by goldfish, but I don't know. I think they're cool, and you could get a really nice one and keep it in there. And I wouldn't really recommend necessarily you keep a common goldfish in there because it'd get too big, but one fancy goldfish would work. But I really kind of like the idea of putting an angelfish in there, setting it up for an angelfish, because then you can aquascape it and put plants in if you want to, not have to worry about the angelfish destroying them, but you have a large specimen fish in there. So, there you go.
Joe from Hudsonville says, "Hello, right down to business. Siesta period with a low-tech setup, i.e. no CO2. Just dosing with Excel every day or every other day. Is it worth it? Benefits or drawbacks?"
Okay. I have not tried a siesta period with a low-tech setup. I'm trying to remember if I've done a siesta period with a high-tech setup or not, because it's been a while. I haven't really done a high-tech tank for a while with regards to a CO2 tank with high light. Haven't done it for a while, so I don't think I've done a siesta period in a low tank, though. I'm pretty sure I have not. However, I looked this up, and I will put a couple of links up, but to just kind of paraphrase what Diana Wallstedt says on Aquatic Plant Central about this, she indicates that, yes, it is useful to do, it's worth it, and this is where she gets her reasoning, okay? She says, now, I'm not saying exactly what her dosing regimen is, but this is basically one of her Wallstedt tanks, so any kind of fertilization would be very minimal, at least for the first while when she's got it set up, because she's, you know, got the soil underneath the top substrate and relying on that and fish waste for nutrients, essentially. Although we have, when she was on our show, we talked about changing one of those tanks eventually to a higher tech tank once the nutrient levels from the soil have decreased. Anyway, I'm kind of digressing here. So, she says that she measured with several tanks CO2 levels early in the morning, 7 a.m., and then she tested them at various times throughout the day, and she tested with a siesta period to determine how that was. She found that if, when she tested, let me see, I'm going to open up this link if I can, because I don't want to get the numbers wrong. It's not opening for me. Well, I won't quote the exact numbers, but I'll give you the gist of it, and you can look it up, because I will put this link on the show page, and you can check it out. But anyway, she said CO2 was fairly high in the morning, just after the lights turned on, because the plants hadn't been, you know, photosynthesizing all night. And so the CO2 was fairly high, and it dropped till about noon. So from 7 to noon, started out high and dropped as the plants were photosynthesizing. When the siesta period was put in place, it was implemented, the CO2 for a couple of hours, the CO2 increased again and then decreased when the light was on. When there wasn't a siesta period, the CO2 just stayed low. So the plants weren't able to do a whole lot. So yes, at least with the Wallstad method, which she did on several tanks, and it seemed that these results were consistent, if you do a siesta period, you will get some benefit from it in that the CO2 levels will go up and the plants will photosynthesize after they've had the rest period. And if you don't have a siesta period and the CO2 is exhausted, algae can grow quite favorably in that kind of situation and start being a problem. So it may indeed be beneficial even in lower tech tanks, is what I get from it. So you should check that out. Check the link out. This is, again, from Aquatic Plant Central. In the search terms, lighting, siesta, CO2, will probably get you there, but we'll put the link up so you can use it. Now, I'm experiencing a technical difficulty that's not letting me look at the rest of the document because there is additional text on here. So I'm going to try to shortcut out of that and get somewhere else because I know we have it. So sorry for this pause. It's not going to be super long. Okay, here we go. This is where the rest of the text picks up.
Okay.
Number two.
I was told by my LFS that there aren't that many plants that grow well in sand, fluorite black sand. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, though I have used fluorite in various forms in various tanks and have been pleased with the results, I have never tried fluorite sand of any sort. I've tried fluorite black, I've tried fluorite red, and I think I've just tried plain old fluorite. And in, like I said, various tanks. I like this stuff. It seems to work. However, the sand I've not tried. So I have used other types of sand. I've used Tahitian moon sand, for example. I would say that I can't say a lot about it because I haven't done it. But in general, I did a quick search on this to see what people were saying, and some of the things that people were mentioning is that the sand is light and gets kicked up easily. And that has been my experience with some of the other sands, like the Tahitian moon sand that I've used, which is essentially inert, unlike fluorite black sand, which has iron in it that it provides and so on. It got kicked up fairly easily and kind of made a mess, so I didn't really like it. And I actually took it out of the tank and put some different substrate in. But that may or may not be applicable to your specific setup. Kind of depends on what you're keeping. I was keeping a large group of coolie loaches in it, so they were always kicking it up.
He also says, I feel like it might have been covered in previous shows, but I am lazy and don't want to go back and find them. How would one go about breeding cardinal tetras and also panda cori cats?
Panda cori cats? Okay. Well, I, again, have not bred cardinal tetras or panda cori cats. I've had neon tetras spawn for me, and I've had cori cats of other species spawn for me. At least one other species spawned for me, but I, in both cases, I never ended up raising any of the young. My neons would spawn all the time whenever I changed the water. And I would get, the coris would just spawn occasionally, but I never ended up raising the babies. I was never doing it on purpose. They would just spawn, and so I never really had anything set up to raise them. At any rate, so my experience with those spawning those two species you mentioned is non-existent. However, I would like to open that up to anybody who has spawned them. If they would like to provide us with some information on how they did that, that would be great. I could give you some basic info on how to spawn fish, you know, but I don't think that's what you're asking for, because I think, you know, there's a lot of really basic spawning tips that are almost universal or tend to be generalizable to many species, but like I said, I don't think that's exactly what you're asking, so I will have to defer to other Aquariumaxers out there who have spawned those species. I know cardinals are supposed to be fairly challenging. That's why a lot of them are still collected in the wild, not like neon tetras, which are super easy to farm. But, yeah, so please, if you have done it and would like to comment on it, let us know.
Okay. Would a drove dwarf cobalt gourami or two fit well in a 55-gallon low-tech planted tank with cardinal tetras, two very small bristlenose plecos, and currently four panda cory cats. Also a bunch of red cherry shrimp.
Well, I think the gourami would probably do fine in there in terms of the tetras and the bristlenose plecos and the panda cory cats. I think they would be a little rough on the shrimp. So that's my general feeling. I mean, I know some people feel that they don't want to mix Asian fish with South American fish, not only for reasons of, you know, biotope or whatever, but some of the concerns that have been raised is that their immunity profiles are a little different, and so it can be easier to make one or the other group sick because they, you know, they don't have immunity to the same diseases. Another issue is that sometimes aggression and body language might be different from fish from one continent to another. I don't know if I buy that or not, but I've heard it. Anyway, I would say that you'll probably be fine, except your cherry shrimp population will probably suffer. I haven't done that particular combination before, but that is my guess, that you might, depending on how heavily planted and what kind of cover you have in the tank. And I've seen the picture of your tank, and it looks really cool. There's not a lot of cover in there right now, and I'm sure you're planning on, you know, growing the plants out more so that there will be more cover in that tank, and that will help. But at this point, I think you'd end up with losing quite a few of your shrimp, depending on how delicious the gouramis find them.
He asks, how would Plaides fit in with the above-mentioned tank?
I think it would be similar. Plaides or Plaides, depending on how you choose to pronounce it, would probably go after the shrimp to some degree too, certainly freshly molted ones and baby ones. And so you probably wouldn't get as much shrimp reproduction. I have kept breeding populations of red cherry shrimp with small fish like guppies and tetras, neon tetras, things like that. So I'm not going to say that they'll destroy the population entirely, but they'll probably reduce it. And then, of course, depending on whether or not you put the gouramis in there, partly, the panda corys and the cardinal tetras, at least while they're small, are not likely to completely eliminate baby platies, but they'll probably take some of them. The cardinal tetras, when they get bigger, probably more of them. But the gouramis would definitely pick a lot of them off, but you don't really have to worry about the plecos or panda corys doing that. So, yeah, you could put them in, and it just depends on what kind of population you're looking at doing.
He has two pictures attached, including how his 55 gallons started out. He also asks, can you identify this plant? I think it looks like hornwort. I pulled it out of a local lake called Upper Silver Lake.
Okay. Well, I wish I could say it is hornwort, but I don't think it is. I think it is Eurasian milfoil. And I could be wrong, but, I mean, the genus Myriophyllum, which is the milfoils, looks like that. I mean, that's what they look like. And I know that that species, based on the research, and I'll put a link up to the link, I'll put the link to the page that I was reading on it, because I looked at that and I thought, that looks like Myriophyllum or milfoil to me. I didn't know which species. I figured I knew the genus. So I looked it up, and it seems like it is Myriophyllum spicatum, which I think that's the name for the Eurasian milfoil, which is not native to the U.S., but is abundant in many parts of the U.S. Hornwort is a little different in that it doesn't have quite the feathery appearance. It's more like a bottle brush sort of appearance. But you can see that each of the leaflets that stick off the stems here are kind of like a feather. I think this plant has been called parrot's feather on occasion for that reason. But anyway, I think that's what it is. I know that some states are trying hard to control it because it can be a pest. So you might want to be careful where you move it. It may or may not be legal for you to even move such a plant from one place to another. I'm not sure. So you might want to check into your local laws and see how that is. But even though it does have some similarities to hornwort, I think that is a myriophyllum plant, probably the Eurasian milfoil. So, and thank you for sending the pictures of the tank. I think it looks like it's off to a great start. Really nice tank there. And I'll look forward to updates, seeing how the plants grow in and what you end up actually stocking it with. I mean, finishing the stocking process with, I should say. All right. And I think that's all for our contributors this week. If you haven't yet, you might want to check out, I know that you're well beyond your first tank, most of you, but if you want to check out my new video series, Your First Tank, I have now completed the 7th episode, which is on YouTube, which is scheduled to go out the end of this week. Got some other stuff there. You want to check out my my multis. I just was feeding them, I think I mentioned this, how I was feeding them some bloodworms and some mosquito larvae that I found out in the backyard. I posted a video of that. And I've also got my Daphnia moved into the house. I've got, took some of them in and started them up in a four-ish gallon tank. And they're doing really well. I started feeding them to my multis to try to get them to breed more, because, as I said, I found one multi fry. I see it once in a while. I don't think they're any more in there, but they could be hiding in the shells, trying to kind of stimulate them to breed a little more, so giving them the fresh food and so on. Gave them quite a bit of Daphnia the other day. It turns out that the larger Daphnia are too big of this species of the Daphnia that I have. The larger specimens are too big for all but the large male in the tank. All the rest of them can't quite get them down, but they can get the younger ones down. So now I'm going to have to figure out a way to just collect the smaller ones, or at least sort them or something, so that I can give them Daphnia and they'll actually be able to eat them. It looks like they can get every size or every stage beyond the largest adults. So I'll be playing with that and figuring out a good way to do that. I know that you can do graduated like meshes in different jars and things like that. I might end up doing something like that. I just don't know that I have meshes of all the different sizes I would need, but it's worth a try. We'll see what I can come up with. Anyway, I think that's it. Thank you, Laurelyn, for joining us today. She's making a gesture that doesn't make any noise, so you can't tell, but it looks
I
like
just waved.
She waved, yeah. So thank you for joining us, and Kelly will be back with us next week. So in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, may the fish
be with you.
Oh, you want to push that button?
Okay.
Push that button right there. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.